This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, to mark Earth Day, Christopher Carpenter, winemaker for Jackson Family Estates, joins us from Napa to talk about going organic, cutting carbon emissions, reducing water use, regenerative viticulture, soil health. In short, how to make wine that doesn't cost the earth. The 22nd of April is Earth Day, an annual celebration to raise awareness of the need to protect the planet's natural resources for future generations. The drinks world can and should do its bit, of course. So this week we're joined by Christopher Carpenter, who's led the transition of the Jackson family wineries in the Napa Valley and also in the McLaren Vale in Australia to organic farming with the focus on regenerative viticulture. Beyond that change, the company, which has 40 wineries all over the world, has pledged to halve its carbon emissions by 2030, becoming climate positive by 2050. As a co-founder with Spain's Torres of International Wineries for Climate Action, the first wine organisation to become a member of the UN's Race to Zero campaign. Well, there's plenty to talk about. Chris, welcome to The Drinking Hour.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, glad to have you there. Just by way of introduction, tell us about those estates for which you have responsibility.
So I'm responsible for approximately 400 acres in the Napa Valley. We have property on four different mountain sides and then sprinkled throughout the valley. I also oversee, from a general management standpoint, the vineyards in Walla Walla in the Mill Creek area of Washington State.
It's a big job. And here's a big question, which might sound a bit like a stupid question with an obvious answer, but I think it's important to pose it. Why do you and your colleagues feel the need to take action on climate change?
That's an excellent question. I think it's twofold. From a personal as well as corporate standpoint, there's a responsibility that we have as farmers to not only the land and the long-term vision of being able to farm on these properties, but to the people that benefit from working on that property, from the products that we're producing, and from the long-term health of the environment that the properties are around. You know, agriculture in general, if you look at the statistics, is contributing anywhere from 25 to 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions from a production standpoint into the atmosphere. That's a significant amount of gas moving from our industry into the atmosphere. Just to put it in perspective, if you look at air travel and jets and such, their input's about 3%, 3 to 4%. So you can imagine the burden of responsibility that we have, that we should, as an industry, be looking to change, to mitigate. That's a big part of my understanding of the environmental responsibility that I have. And then the company feels that way too, not only from an agricultural standpoint, but from the other point of our business, which is making wine, there are inputs that are and outputs that we're generating that we want to be able to mitigate. You know, this is a family that I work for that wants to be in this business for a very long time. And if we're not shepherding those properties rather than just completely extracting from those properties, then that business isn't going to be around for very much longer. You know, the agriculture as a whole should be leading this charge. And our company feels very strongly that viticulture, the part of agriculture that we reside, because we are so visible in the world, that we should be leading that as a group.
And it's sobering when you hear those figures. And also sobering, you're based in the Napa Valley. And last time I was there was smoke actually from a fire further up north. It wasn't causing problems to viticulture at that point, but it was very evident. And you've experienced there some pretty terrifying extremes from wildfires to drought, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. And the interesting thing, and we've talked about this, I think, as a society across the globe, that those extremes are becoming more frequent. And whether it's wildfires or flooding or drought or the invasiveness of different species that are finding footholds in new environments that they weren't able to survive in previously, the climate is changing, and it's not changing in a linear fashion. It's changing logarithmically. And if we are hoping to survive, you know, I make wine, and wine's a wonderful product, and it has certain benefits across a emotional and a physical and a memory-based standpoint. But we're in agriculture, and we also grow food. If we're not looking at how this planet is evolving around us and thinking about how, as a species, we're going to survive to grow food, we're not doing anybody any good. And a lot of that understanding is what motivates me.
Tell us what you're doing then, because you have Rooted for Good, this roadmap to 2030. What does it entail?
Well, it entails a number of things. In the agricultural side, we are looking at all different kinds of strategies, from a farming system strategy. So in Napa and in Walla Walla, under my oversight, we're 100% organic farming. We're moving towards regenerative farming, which takes organic to another level and kind of does a bit more of a partnership with Mother Nature than a more aggressive relationship. Right before this chat that we're having, I was in a meeting about water conservation in our vineyards and trying to understand how I can be more efficient with my irrigation so I'm not using water strictly on a calendar basis and maybe using too much water at times or not meeting the demands of those plants at the precise moment. So those kind of strategies we're looking at, you know, it's about conservation as well as about, again, shepherding the land that we have. On the winery side, we've implemented solar panels. We're, I believe, the largest winery user of solar panels in the industry, at least in California. We are utilizing water-saving strategies in the wineries. You know, when I first got into the business, I believe for every 1 gallon of water we would use 16, or I'm sorry, for every 1 gallon of wine we would produce, we were using 16 gallons of water. Multiply that by 4 and you get your liters. We've reduced that down to almost, I think it's 1 to 3 now, and we're probably pretty close to getting to 1 to 2, and you know, ultimately it'd be a 1 to 1 ratio would be the best scenario. Those strategies, we've downweighted glass in our production capacity, you know, from the smallest increment of weight that we lose in a bottle of wine does so much good across a wide swath of the production of glass. Not only the heat that you need to generate to produce that glass that ultimately gets the refuse of that heat gets pumped into the atmosphere, but moving that glass around once it has wine in it, the heavier the glass is, the more fuel it takes to move from point A to point B, whether it's on a boat or on a train or on a truck. There's those kind of, you know, strategies. And as incremental as they seem, every little bit helps. And when you're making the volumes of wine that Jackson Family makes, those small increments per bottle add up quite a bit. And every bit of that kind of pressure that we can relieve on the environment, we look at.
And you have led the team transitioning the 15 Napa estates, also the one in Australia I mentioned, to organic farming. Now, why are you doing that? Because it's not necessarily to do with sustainability, the stuff you've just been mentioning about water use and bottle weight and so forth, is it?
How you farm affects the overall environment in so many different ways. It's not just about saving water. I mean, again, with regenerative farming and some of the strategies that we're pursuing under organic, there is quite a bit of savings, but it's also the inputs that we're putting into the atmosphere and into the soils. You want a healthy environment. What we've done as a species is create unhealthy environments across the planet. If we can bring some of those environments back to equilibrium, then we're the downslope of that decision. It can only benefit us. So, for example, in organic farming, there's a vast reduction in the amount of chemical inputs that are put into the soil. Those chemical inputs, often when rains happen, those chemical inputs get washed into our river systems and then ultimately into the waterways that sustain our seafood industry. You know, that those chemical inputs are no good for anybody. They're a strategy that's a stopgap in how we control pests and allow for rapid growth of the plant material that we deal with. But in the end, that doesn't really help the plants because the plants then don't have the kind of immune system that allows them to flourish in times of stress. By reducing those inputs, we're not putting those chemicals into our soils, which doesn't get them into the waterways, which then preserve some of the fisheries that are available and the health of our lakes and oceans and such. And then we're also creating plants that can survive in extreme conditions, which we need to have those plants stronger now. And all of those things then ultimately create more of an equilibrium in the environment, which will ultimately help us survive this mess we've created.
So organic vines are stronger, healthier, more resistant vines.
Theoretically, that's exactly what's happening.
Right.
Think of it this way. I used this analogy in another chat that I was doing. You know, if you take a human and you pump them with steroids so that they can get big and strong, there's a momentary benefit to that person who's using those anabolic steroids. They get bigger, they get stronger, they hit more home runs, or they tackle more people in American rules football, right? But then they go off of those steroids, and the health ramifications to their livers, to their skin, to their kidneys, to their heart, those long-term effects, they can't get rid of, and they have health problems later on in life that make them weaker. It's the same thing when you're utilizing chemicals to enhance the growth patterns of vines or to make them resistant to certain pests, mostly insect pests or fungal pests. If you take them off of those products, those vines have become used to that, and they struggle to survive in an environment where they don't have those kind of inputs. We're creating vines and resistance systems that in times of extreme, they'll have a better chance of surviving. They're not as big or as strong as somebody, or you know, going back to the human analogy, they wouldn't be as big as or as strong as those people on those steroids, but they're gonna last a lot longer, and they're gonna have a lot more fight in them when it comes to the extreme conditions that they're in.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just explain regenerative viticulture, because that is linked to all of this to an extent, but also different.
Well, the regenerative viticulture is trying to utilize the environment to our benefit, right? And to create systems that feed into one another. So again, two examples of that. We use sheep to mow the vineyards in the early spring before we have bud break in the vines. And the idea with using sheep is that the sheep benefit from being able to eat the weed species that are in between the vines. They've got nice fresh plant species that they love. They then, you know, their feces is on our vineyard, which goes back into the vineyard and is used as a nutrient source for the vines. They have very little impact from a pressure standpoint as they move through the vines versus if we were to send tractors in there, which compact the soil. So the soils stay relatively healthy, you know, very healthy, not relatively healthy. And in spring, when the buds break, we pull them out of there and everything is mowed down, and we haven't spent any money on fuel, and the fuel hasn't burned and sent its gases into the atmosphere. So everybody wins in that case. You know, we look at IPM methodology. So IPM is a subsystem of regenerative called integrated pest management, where you use other species of organisms to control pest species in your vineyard. So for example, mites. Mites are these, not microscopic, but they're really, really small arachnids that can devastate the leaf surface typically of your vine. And there's two specific species that we deal with as pests in our vineyards. Well, there is a predatory mite that we apply into the vineyard, which is just another organism that will then eat those pest mites and create an equilibrium in the vineyard. Now, we never get rid of them fully, but again, we're creating vines that can deal with them at a little bit higher level because we're not spraying for them. We're not completely wiping out that species. We find where the predatory mite populations balance with the pest mite population, and the vines do just fine. You know, those are things where you're utilizing what's natural in biological systems versus synthetic. And that's key to this regenerative farming methodology, is thinking about those strategies at every step of the way.
And you have owls as well, don't you?
Yeah, we use owls, we use hawks, we in fact, I'm trying to find a source for gopher snakes so that I can send gopher snakes into the vineyard. On a couple of my vineyards, I have big rodent problems, and you know, there are other strategies to get rid of rodents. We can trap them, which is a pretty non-impactful way of moving them out, but that takes a tremendous amount of time. Or we could poison them, or we could blow them up with propane by flooding their dens and then igniting it. But if you release snakes into the vineyard, the snakes will reach that exact same kind of steady state. You know, so it's that same, that thought process of being creative within the natural world and creating more of a natural environment in agriculture, which is not a natural environment. You know, so you want to try to be as connected to the natural world as possible. And that's what regenerative is about.
Yeah. And when you think of the natural world, you might think of this romantic image of someone plowing a field, tilling the soil. But actually, you try to avoid that, don't you?
We don't till the soil at all in any of our vineyards. There's an environment, an entirely other world that lives in the soil, and that other world is made up of fungal organisms, of plant roots, of bacteria, of microscopic worms called nematodes, of insects. And when that world is left to itself, it is an incredibly healthy environment for growing plants in. In fact, the fungal networks connect to the plant roots and create a communication system that allows plants to talk to one another, and it's not exactly talking to one another. There are chemical processes that are on these pathways that are really important for plant health. As soon as you bring a tractor in and break up the soil, you're breaking up those communication networks. So we try to reduce that as much as possible and try to keep the impact on that soil as low as possible. And again, going back to the sheep, when you have a 100-pound lamb, or not lamb, but sheep walking through a vineyard versus a 5-ton tractor, the pressure on the soil is greatly reduced, and maintaining those environments, the soil environment, to a very much more precise way.
I have friends who garden, and they very keenly, and so do I actually. I'm not very good at it, but I like doing it. And they're really into, in their veg gardens, they're really into no-dig gardening. And I guess it's the same principle, isn't it?
It's very much the same principle. There's a woman, I can't remember her name. She did her PhD on these fungal network attachments to the tree species that she studied. And the kind of communications that happen in these networks, it's amazing. And it's something that, if you look at, I mean, vines are very much like trees. They're perennials and they have networks. And if we can maintain those in any way, that's my goal. And there's very stressful moments doing that. There's different weather events. You can mitigate some of the weather events by tilling the soil. But I'm a firm believer in that. If you can build the health of those vines in a natural environment, then even in those extreme events, you won't have to utilize those strategies.
And tell us whether you think, obviously, you're doing this for a reason, and that reason is around the future of the planet. But I wonder if, as a very experienced winemaker, do you think that you can taste the benefit of things like organic viticulture?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? And something that I thought about very deeply before I embarked on this. And fortunately for me, there's been, I used to be a very much involved in an organization called Slow Food. And Slow Food is a food systems organization that stemmed out of a protest in Italy around food as a commodity versus as a cultural marker. Having been involved in Slow Food and tasted foods from a range of organic farming systems around the planet as I traveled and talking with farmers from anybody from growing olives to peaches to row crop vegetables, the food was always better. There was a more intense flavor to it. It had a depth and a weight of flavor that it was like nothing I had experienced from foods that I had been picking up at the supermarket. That knowledge gave me a lot of confidence as I moved into the viticulture side. And I got to tell you, we've been farming organically in Napa now for 5 years, I think, maybe six. The fruit's better. And as a result, the wine is better. It's that intensity. We have reduced a little bit of our volume, and that's to be expected, but that volume loss has been eclipsed by the quality gains that we've achieved.
That's really interesting. And yeah, I mean, I know what you say. I can definitely taste organic in food, I think, through a kind of deeper, richer sense of taste. And there's no reason that shouldn't follow through for wine either. And I'm pretty convinced I can taste that too. But your view on that is probably more useful than mine. Tell us about the International Wineries for Climate Action. Jackson Family Estates, a co-founder with Torres of Spain.
Well, again, it's the same idea that as a group in agriculture, vineyards and wineries have a lot of, you know, exposure, and exposure in a good way. We, you know, nobody is tracking the activities of a number of dairies or a alfalfa farm or as a group, but the public is very much aware of wineries and the wines that they produce and our presence in the agricultural world. And a group like the IWCA is taking advantage of that, to the fact that we should be leaders in this. This is an industry that we have financial presence that we can run a number of the experiments on that can prove some of these strategies, and a coalition of like-minded wineries working together helps to raise that profile. And this is the dominating founding ideas behind the IWCA. And you know, a family like the Torres, one of the more important families in Spain, and the Jacksons here in the U.S., amongst some of the other smaller wineries, that our goal is to get as much of that knowledge out there. So not only will the public benefit from that, but our colleagues in other forms of agriculture can look to us as a model and can implement some of these things. And we've done a lot of that work for them.
At Jackson Family Estates, you've pledged in this roadmap to halve carbon emissions by 2030. Climate positive, so therefore no emissions by 2050. Why can't you do it earlier than 2050? That's a long way off.
It is a long way off. And there's a number of things that are entwined in that. For one, we're not doing it with carbon offset acquisition. You have to be very careful when you see some of the advertisements for different companies purporting to be carbon neutral. You got to read the fine print. Are they carbon neutral because they're trying to do everything incrementally as we are? And that incremental change happens over time. It takes a long time. Sometimes a long time to make these changes when you're a company as large as ours. Or are you buying carbon offsets? We are not buying carbon offsets. We're trying to be truly carbon neutral by all of these strategies that we're implementing. And we're ambitious. I mean, that's a pretty ambitious goal, actually. We want to cut our carbon emissions in half by 2030. That's pretty ambitious. You know, we've started to move our fleet of pickup trucks in the vineyards over to electric. We're looking at moving our fleet of tractors over to electric. That takes a lot of time, takes a lot of financial backing. And we have some of that, but we don't have all of it. And, you know, those things are a step-by-step process. We aren't slowing down, I will tell you that. It's just that we're trying to be realistic about it.
I'm interested in electric tractors. I mean, I'm not really, because I'm not really interested in tractors, but I know that I have an electric car, fully electric, and I know that it's a brilliant technology, but it is much more challenging for big vehicles that require sort of brute force, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's a big part of the challenge with electric tractors is you can get them. In fact, we have just brought over an electric tractor in Napa from a company called Monarch. And we're also looking at another company called Nio that's actually an electric tractor. It's a fully automated electric tractors, or a robot. And the thing with these vehicles are you can charge them for a good amount of time. I believe the Monarch has a 6-hour life on their battery, which is, you know, a pretty much a full work day given other things that happened during that time. But as soon as you put implements on the back of them and you add weight to those and then put those implements in the ground, you'd reduce that amount of time. So the big challenge, and this is, I think, the big challenge with the entire electric vehicle industry, is creating batteries that have longer lifetimes, can ramp up in different power modes, and, you know, from my standpoint, aren't using technology that extracts from the ground in some of the worst places in the world to be extracting from, cobalt being one of the main compound or elements that is used in these things. So, you know, that's a baby step, right? And we're trying to figure out strategies that we can use these that make sense from an efficiency standpoint, as well as from the reliability of those products.
You hit on something very interesting there with your mention of cobalt and battery technology and the elements that have to go into battery production, because there is an extent, I know from talking to people about sustainability, where it was likened to whack-a-mole by someone to me very memorably, where you solve one problem, but you kind of cause another at the same time. It's a challenge.
Yeah. Well, I think what happens is, and this is just my opinion, mind you, I think what happens is we find a solution that, as you mentioned, is, takes care of one problem, and we work so quickly to get to that solution that we do create other problems. But there's other solutions that will come down the line, I hope. You know, you take, for example, the hydrogen battery technology that hopefully will become something that is more prevalent in the future. That technology wasn't worked on as quickly as lithium battery technology. So, you know, the short answer is, yeah, you do sometimes create other problems, but hopefully you have the momentum and the will to look at other solutions along the way. And I think we do as a species, we better.
Indeed. I mean, there are those who say that actually it's all too late now, and we can't really do anything anymore. What do you say to those people?
Well, I mean, the one thing that I think humanity has had and has kept us moving forward is hope. And that sounds like a doomsday scenario that I don't want to be part of. I've got children, and hopefully soon they'll start having grandchildren. I want those people to be around for a long time and to enjoy this beautiful place called Earth that we have as a home. And we're smart enough, and we should be motivated enough to create solutions. It might be too late, but maybe we can dial it back for a while. We're not going to stop procreating, I don't think. So we better think of ways that are going to create an environment that's long-term. I don't believe that. My short answer is I don't believe that. I believe that we can make changes. We just have to all be on the same page to do that. And we have to be able to support one another and do things a little bit drastically that we've lived a very, as a species in this last 200 years of industrialization, our life styles have become very comfortable. And you know, that was the emphasis and the onus of technological change. Well, we may not be as comfortable in the future, but maybe we're still around. And it may, you know, that's something that we're going to have to embrace, I think.
And that is a very important point to leave it, really, because, I mean, we could talk for hours, but it's we've covered a lot, and you have done a lot there. So I applaud you for that as we mark Earth Day. And Chris, thanks so much for taking the time out. I can hear the emails popping in the background. I know you're a very busy man, so thanks for taking the time out to talk to us on the Drinking Hour.
You know, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. This is something I'm very connected to. And the more people that we can get to think about solutions, you know, whether it's as simple as you not tilling your garden, it's the little things. It's the if you do that and another 100 people do that, that adds up after a while. So,
well, let's raise a glass to that. Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Happy Earth Day.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
We round off as ever with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame. And here's one from Jackson Family Estates. It's actually their property in South Africa in the Western Cape. Capensis Wines, Selene 2021, won not just a gold medal, but it was also a trophy winner. So best in show. This is a Chardonnay from Stellenbosch. The judging overseen by Dersi Viana Jr., Master of Wine, and Sophia Longhi was on the panel as well. And they were recent guests on the Drinking Hour just a few weeks ago, talking about that judging process. Here's their tasting note. A delicate nose led by citrus notes leads to a layered and complex palate showing butterscotch, nuts, tangerine, passion fruit and spice. This is silky and poised with well-integrated oak and a long finish. Well, let's give Torres a mention as well, co-founders of the International Wineries for Climate Action, the IWCA, as we heard. Torres 15 Reserva Privada Brandy won a gold medal with a hugely impressive 97 points. Our good friend Joel Harrison overseeing the judging here. And the tasting note, sophisticated, elegant nose of raisin, dark cacao, and a subtle weave of leathery, savoury notes. Rounded and full on the palate, salted caramel and stewed fruits emerge alongside orange peel and honeycomb before a gorgeous finish of vanilla and clove. Sounds delicious. And here's a zero alcohol innovation from Torres that scored the highest silver score, 94 points, just shy of a gold. It's a rosé style, Familia Torres Sangre de Toro Rosé 2022. The tasting note, a bright, inviting nose of green gauge, vanilla and soft nutmeg spice. The mid-palate follows with caramel, tartness and coconut. Finishes with sour strawberry laced with vanilla sorbet. Here's a low alcohol innovation from another member of the IWCA, Yeelands this time in Marlborough, New Zealand. We recently heard from chief winemaker there, Natalie Christensen. The Crossings Light Wave Sauvignon Blanc 2022, silver medal winner. This one is just 8% alcohol. Here's what the judges said. Lovely Sauvignon Blanc nose with lots of tropical fruit on the palate. Juicy, well-integrated acidity with a rich and textured body. A good example of a low ABV Sauvignon Blanc. And finally, let's round off with a champagne. Champagne Lançon Les Blancs de Blanc Brut Non-Vintage. Lançon's been a member of the IWCA since January 22, and this was a silver medal winner with 91 points, the judging overseen by Essie Avalan MW, and the panel described this as cheerfully scrumptious with mouth-watering notes of crisp green apples, zesty lemon, juicy white peach and savoury bread, possesses a gloriously persistent finish that sparkles with vibrant charm, they said. And that's it for this week. My thanks to Chris Carpenter for helping us mark Earth Day 2024. Until next time, it's goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
T
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.